Hello, and welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I should say Guelph Off Campus and Community Radio, but that's okay.
Yes.
I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz, off campus in the Hertz bunker, still short up the windows with plywood. No, I didn't actually. That's got to get some fresh air somehow, so... But hanging in, internet connection's holding on, so we can do this, which is great. I've seen lots of trucks in the neighborhood, so it sounds like that system might be strained to the max as well, but hopefully our connection will hold for the duration.
Mm-hmm.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can find us here every Thursday at 5 p.m. as we talk about the latest news items from Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and around the world, and we sometimes interview local newsmakers and politicians, which this week will be Guelph Member of Parliament, Lloyd Longfield, and he will be here, well, here being relative, at the bottom of the hour, and he's going to talk about... the various new announcements from the federal government from, I want to call it cottage news, because that's kind of what it feels like. It happens at the same time every day, and it's outside the cottage, and I think they should just call it cottage news.
Cottage industry news, yeah. The new cottage industry is everything remote.
Yeah. So we'll leave the federal stuff for a moment, because I think the bigger news right now is what's happening with the long-term care home situation. And I mean, this is something that's happening in Ontario, but it's also happening in Quebec and Alberta too. It's half of all COVID-19 deaths so far in Canada have been in our long-term care homes. And we get this report from the CBC yesterday, Wednesday, that says that 9 out of the province's 626 homes were inspected in 2019. And I wanted you to launch into a Hertz rant on this, because I know you have some not inconsiderable experience with, you know, parents in long-term care homes. Were you surprised by that report?
No, I'm actually not surprised by that at all. Anybody who follows me online knows that I've the Hertz rant was opened pretty wide. For the people that don't know, I did have a fairly lengthy, substantial experience with the care homes. I don't really want to name any names, and also some crossover with the hospital and the hospital situation in town as it was. And there's, I guess, there's also still some issues there. But yeah, to stick with care homes, in terms of the story about those inspections, and I should mention, it's not, I mean, it's obviously hitting Ontario pretty hard with, I guess, what was it, like 800 of the cases are in either retirement nursing homes or long-term care homes. But it's worldwide. And as you are doing, as I am, following the stories either out of America and the UK and places that we consider to be, let's just say, first world, for lack of a better word, they are all getting hit. There was a story out of, and to sort of expand the horizon a little bit, story out of New Jersey where there's a catastrophic situation in a home, not unlike the one in Quebec and the one we've seen in Bob Cajun, where it was so bad that somebody had called in a body or somebody being stored in a shed because they had run out of room. Like, this is apocalyptic stuff in terms of if you are of a certain age. Now, that's not to say any of that is happening in Ontario, but the potential is there, absolutely. Considering that, I guess it's studies, and I've gone worldwide already, but there is bigger picture to this too. Study out of the UK and of Italy saying that, you know, 90% of the people who are dying of COVID-19 have existing health conditions, as most people do in long term care. That's why you end up in long-term care generally, and also age. So those two factors alone are a reflection of what is going on with this virus, with this disease. Now, the inspection thing, there is, and this is, I'm going to go into opinion now, so people, this is my opinion. There is long-term company corporations and people involved who own long-term care homes have fairly deep influence with politics in this province. It's not a secret. There was a story out a couple of weeks ago about how Christine Elliott had received a lot of donations from a particular care home. I don't really want to name names. We know that Hazel McCallion has been an advocate or an ambassador for another long-term care home group. Mike Harris on the, I guess I can say the company, the chair of Chartwell. There is a hell of a lot of overlap between politics and long-term care homes in this province. And as to how deep that influence goes, I think we are going to see all of that. And I think that's why when you see, in particular, the press conference with Doug Ford and Christina Light standing in the background, she looks like she's been sideswiped. She has that. I mean, things are bad. Things are really bad across the province. But I think there's this sort of background story going on that is really, when it all comes out, and it's all coming out now, is going to seriously be a train wreck for them. And if it isn't, we still have a problem. Absolutely have a problem, because the ties are far too deep, in my opinion.
Right. And I've already seen at least one person say that, and this is like almost verbatim from the tweets, I saw somebody say, you know, Doug Ford's homage to Mike Harris is complete with his Walkerton. Basically saying that this situation with the neglect, which may be too harsh a word, but I mean, it seems apt.
Oh, no, it's neglect.
Yeah.
No, it's not too harsh a word at all. And this is the problem. They say, well, you're not really, well, we're working on this problem. You're not supposed to get political. It is political. Everything, I mean, part of why we do the show, but generally, it's you know what I'm saying.
Okay, everything is political. Yeah.
I'm in Hertz mode. Phone's going to melt. Right? It is true. These things are specifically political. It's for political reasons that things happen. It's for political reasons that inspections in care homes are down, because as we know, the trend is to self-police things, be it, you know, oil companies or whatever. It's like, well, they can look after it, no problem, because they are the experts. Wrong, wrong, wrong.
So, right.
I think I should just, you know what, rather than just keep going on and sucking up all the time, I'll just write a blog about it and be prepared. So,
well, it's not the worst idea.
It's been a while, and you know, when you get into the mode, it's like, man, because I've been holding off on dumping on this for a long time.
Right.
And now might be the time, so
stay tuned. You're right. But as you were talking, I remembered, too, that initially Christine Elliott's cabinet role was Deputy Premier, Minister of Health, and Minister of Long-Term Care. And when they reshuffled the cabinet last summer, long-term care was spun off into its own separate thing, with Dr. Marilee Fullerton now as the cabinet minister in charge of long-term care. It makes you wonder to a degree if they, I mean, not that they saw it coming, as in like the COVID and the current crisis, but that Elliot was taking on way too much, that part of it was like the long-term care thing where, you know, she has connections in that world. Something had to give. Having said that, by the time we get around to June, when the cabinet is reshuffled, you're still dealing with what seems like a huge backlog in terms of these inspections. Like, they did 2,800 inspections last year, which were in response to specific complaints, because there's two types of inspections. There's these complaint-driven inspections, which, you know, takes a complaint to initiate. But there's also these RQI inspections, which I'm trying to find where I had written down what RQI stands for. The resident quality inspections, where it's basically, it's much more labor-intensive. You go in, you talk to staff, you talk to residents, you talk to the family of residents. They're unannounced, so, you know, people don't have time to prepare, you know, whereas, you know, a complaint is issued, you call the place and say, hey, we got a complaint and we're coming over to check you out. And I mean,
get cleaning. Yeah,
right. And I've worked in enough like stores and things to know that when the upper guys are coming in, you clean more intensely than you typically clean when you give them kind of a lick in the promise, like on a Saturday afternoon, and 1,000 people have been through the store. But yeah, so both are a type of inspection for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to believe that if they were doing the RQIs on an annual basis, like they were supposed to, those 2,800 may not have been as pressing otherwise. And more than that, the fact that they had like 2,800, I mean, broken down, that's like maybe five, I mean, broken down equally across all the long-term care homes, that's like 4.5 complaints about every long-term care home in the province in 1 year. But the 2,800 complaints should have been a warning sign of a bigger problem going on.
Oh, yeah. And just to clarify, I would say, I'm going to put a 99% number on it, of the people that I encountered that were working in long-term care homes, in retirement homes, and in the hospital as well, were given it 110%. I mean,
for sure. Yeah.
Sincerely. And I'm sure it's the same now. I'm sure that's, you know, so many of them are sick and maxed out and whatever. It may even be higher than 99%. So what I've been saying is not slighting anybody who works within that system in the slightest, because as we've seen, and I guess this has come down with the law too, like all of a sudden it's like, oh, people can't work in more than one long-term care home. But structurally, the way that it's structured is that it's like it's gig economy for a lot of people, like to make a living at being a personal support worker or what they do. And of course, all the ancillary things that they do, whether it's physiotherapy and all the things that we don't think about, because it's just strictly, you know, at this point, we're talking about maintenance care, like keeping people alive. Whereas there are all these other, there is a whole network of people and businesses that come in because there's also a degree of private care where you call like a separate business to come in and give your elders extra care when you can't be there. You know, a wide spectrum of people involved, but also, but part of it too, and I'm not sure whether this is going to be explored, and I think that it will be, is that when you initiate the let's call it the government option, when you go to the provincial government and say, I need help, there is a whole industry of contractors that work for the provincial government that will come in and do feeding and care and things that you're not capable of doing because, you know, it's just not within your wheelhouse, right? And that group of people, by design, also travel from place to place to place to place and provide care for, you know, under the auspices of the government.
Right.
And my burning question, because I haven't heard about it yet, but I've got a feeling, I sense that before the month is out, we're going to hear about this. What are they going to do about that system? Because it's not... I think there may have been a point in time, let's say way back, where there was like a, you know, I'm not Victorian Order of Nurses, but that style of organization that was run by the government that did this. And all of that over a period of time has been contracted out.
Right.
Right. So these are contractors that work for the provincial government. They say they give X amount of help to people, but they travel around. And that just by its nature, it's not... not by its nature, but by design, that's how it works, because it's a third party that takes care of it. How do you assign those people to specific care homes? I don't think you can. But what was going on, and it's sort of a bit of an aside too, in Quebec, that they're trying to recruit, the premier is almost pleading with like doctors and surgeons to get involved with the care home situation. It sounds worse, if possible, way worse than Quebec. And we think of Quebec as sort of I think of Quebec at least as a more, to some degree, progressive province in these areas, but yet, you know, some of the stories coming out of there as well, they parallel Ontario. And of course, where across the country are the largest amount of cases? Ontario and Quebec. And where are they? They're in places such as long-term care homes, right? It's just, it's phenomenal to me. Like
I would argue that it's probably worse in Quebec, because they're talking about police investigations of staff in a couple of these particularly terrible long-term care home situations, like the one in Dorval, where there were 31 deaths. Only 5 of them were COVID-related, but it seems like they were so overwhelmed that, you know, people just started dying. And then some of them just walk off the job and leave the residents to their own devices, basically. And there are reports of people at homes who have gone without meals or were kind of left in their own filth. And
but it's that sort of, if it's a question of self-preservation,
yeah,
you can understand why somebody would say, well, I don't want to die, because I can tell you a lot of people that work in those industries are older, for sure. And I would say I've known people that are within the range of like technically seniors or almost seniors, looking after seniors, because that structurally, that is how this is set up. right?
Mm-hmm.
In that it's just they budget for X, you get X amount of people. It's not substantial.
Like, no,
if you want care for your elder in this country and within that system, you need to be involved. You physically need to be involved if you're able, or they're not going to get the level of care that that it has presented in the literature. Right? That's just how it is.
And it's systemic. This isn't something that and we're seeing a lot of this because I see a lot of snarky tweets and stuff about people saying like, oh, all it took for you to embrace socialism is a pandemic. Ha ha ha. But
that's not wrong really in some ways, right?
No. Like,
here's the money, right?
But like in all of these, as you were saying, it's a systemic long-term problem where you have had people working long hours, facilities underfunded, you know, people working for minimum wage, you know, your PSWs.
Registered nurse at night for 200 people.
True story. Right.
And this is before problems. So if two things happen in a night at the same time, what do you do?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is pre, I'm talking before. This is before everything.
Right.
And it's not as if long-term care homes and that weren't susceptible to the pandemic already, because flu is common. Lockdowns are common. It's not, you know, the lockdown right now is unprecedented to the terms of keeping people out of the zone. But influenza, which is similar,
mm-hmm.
Those provisions are the same, and it takes a run through and it kills people. But of course, that's, you know, you'd say that's one thing, and the flu has always been with us. But, you know, this is like, this is flu times 100, times 1,000, right? It's just really, it's a massacre.
Right. You know, and to go along with that too is, you know, you're not only dealing with people who, when you're in those situations, when you are the one nurse on a ward of 200 people, burnout is not uncommon. So it's not only are you not compensating people well, you are burning them out in the process, which makes it harder to hold on to people. And I remember in the months leading up to COVID-19, there was an ad on TV almost three times an hour where it's like, come and be a PSW. You get to have all these great relationships with the older folks, and, you know, we'll pay you for your training. There was a full court press blitz to get people into this industry before there was the pressing need. And I remember when I interviewed Norm Jerry at Riverside Glen, they had a big sign outside in front of Riverside Glen, like, go to this website to find out how to be a PSW.
Yeah. And there's a reason why it's hard to maintain people as PSWs. Cause as you say,
yeah,
well, not just burnout, but you know, if you get sick with just, let's say, run of the mill influenza, that's one thing.
Yeah.
Or just the ailments that, you know, the physical ailments you can get from helping the elders. But then something like COVID, which can kill you, again, a different realm, right? So, you know, there is a reason. And when you see some of the things making the rounds, whether fake news or not, about, and I don't think it is, about people wearing garbage bags for protective equipment, or rain ponchos that were left over from the New York Yankees, in one example in the States, it's like, you know, that's, you know, this is free market elder care. This is what you get.
Right. And that brings us back to the whole, like, socialism angle of it, which is there's going to have to be a reckoning at the end of this, not just in terms of long-term care, but in terms of like our preparedness for another health crisis like this, for treating our newly established essential workforce at the stores with the...
Yeah, magically essential all of a sudden.
Right, with the, you know...
Here's a magic wand. You people who we didn't care about,
right,
slugging the grocers and that, are all of a sudden the most critical workers, you know, coming to that realization. And I love the fact that they're saying, oh, a temporary wage increase. What the hell is that? Like, isn't there something, I'm not sure if you and Lloyd discussed it about the temporary wage boost. I just caught a piece of what Trudeau was saying about what they're now calling essential workers who make less than $2,500 a month,
mm-hmm.
Which is the majority.
Yeah.
I would say the majority, beyond police, fire, ambulance, and not even ambulance, the people that fall within that realm, if they are talking about people working in shops and all those deliveries and the, you know, things that we didn't think of as being essential that are all of a sudden, as I keep saying, magically essential, because it's a term that's thrown around. Because when the crisis inevitably ends, we don't know when that is. Do we go back to, you know, the people working at the supermarket or whatever not being essential anymore, or the Amazon workers,
yeah,
not essential anymore? Because Amazon has been massively problematic, but I'd heard this morning that Bezos wants to test all of the workers. And to me, Bezos is a problematic character, as you probably can imagine. In my world, this guy's like, whatever.
Yeah.
But to implement that is actually smart.
Mm-hmm.
And if these tests that we keep talking about that are coming out, in particular the quick one that's I'm not sure where out of Canada, but this, the little one, the little funky box where you can find out within a half an hour whether somebody's got COVID or not, which is amazing.
Yeah.
I'm not the kind of testing that's going to be rolled out. Now, yeah, if you could have that kind of testing, say, not specifically for Amazon, but they're going to be doing it, like, for a care home.
Yeah.
Or any workplace where there's going to be interaction with people that are at risk, heavier risk, which is pretty much everywhere at this point. If you can test everyone in a workplace or in a care home or in a hospital and say, you, and you, get out of here, you can stay, and consistently do that, then we'll be a lot better off. Because you hear a lot of humming and hawing about testing. Oh, the testing is not that great. If you know if everybody in a location is tested,
mm-hmm,
and everyone is negative, then it's a win, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know why, you know, that something like that needs to be focused on for sure in terms of getting that out, along with all the other things we've been doing, like social distancing and masks seem to be finally coming into coming to the fore in terms of everybody. There's the cottage industry of mask making in town is massive. Like, I don't think there should be anyone in town without a mask these days, by the sounds of it, because I've even ended up with one. I was gifted with a mask. It's actually quite beautiful. that I'm definitely going to wear once I do get out of here, beyond work, to go and restock. You know, the mask will be on. So if you see me, you won't recognize me because I'm going to be masked up.
Right.
But that's the kind of stuff that, you know, certainly needs to happen. Sorry, I once again went off on Intergalactic there.
No. It's all good. I get almost the entire second half to myself talking to Lloyd, so it's all good.
Right, yeah.
Do you want to talk about Donald Trump a little, to sort of like have a bit of fun? Yeah,
I'm laughing, but it's that grim kind of laughter, because now it's just like he also has gone intergalactic, like phenomenal in terms of the stuff that he's, that's a word that he would use, phenomenal.
Although,
phenomenal discussions.
That is,
that guy is unbelievable. And of course, the latest being, and I'm sure most people know this, in terms of scapegoating the WHO for the issues that have befallen the United States, and pulling the funding. I'm not sure which of his gang of like insider toads there came up with that, in terms of let's blame the WHO because it wasn't you. It's got to be one of the advisors has said, okay, let's get some of the heat off of you and let's blame the WHO.
I gotta say, it sounds like patented Jared Kushner to me, but who can know?
Kushner, what's his name? Stephen, the sort of
Mnuchin?
Right-wing, no.
Oh, Stephen Miller.
Nutbar, mysterious advisor guy.
Yeah, Stephen Miller.
Stephen Miller. This sounds like right out of the Stephen Miller playbook. It's like, who can we blame?
No,
because the next thing will be, we need to get the UN out of New York. They need to go somewhere else. That's what will be next, right? Out of it.
Yeah, I'm sure.
The WHO was wanting, you've probably seen some of the press conferences, and the one with the, and I'm afraid I don't know his name, the Irish guy, is like, we were warned in the world January the 2nd. You know, like you can tell that he really wants to open up the barrels on him, but he's like, you know, he was given the old, you know, if you think that we're not doing our job, then you can stuff it, right? That was the tone, and he's not wrong, because that's like, they've been out there. You know, some of the first warnings that we're hearing from at least on the national news and the international news was, the WHO says that this is going to be a problem. Consistently, they haven't been inconsistent in their message. It's like, you need to take these measures, or we are going to see this. And what has happened?
Right? I think that it's one of those situations where you don't want to give credit to Trump, because it's, you know, 300 tons of nonsense in a 100-pound bag. But
yeah, that's a good way to put it.
But at the same time, I mean, I was sort of reviewing the, you know, the past two comments to try and get to the bottom of this. I mean, there is some, I would say there is some cause for concern because, yeah, the WHO was, you know, putting out warnings like, hey, look at this thing in Wuhan, might be worried. But at the same time, you had the head of the WHO, you know, sitting down with President Xi, talking about how great they were responding. And there was an Associated Press report recently that said that there was a 6-day lag between when the Chinese government found out there was a problem and when they decided to inform the public. And as we know, from how the crisis has developed in the West, you know, a week is a lifetime in this crisis. Yeah.
Part of that is diplomacy too, right?
And it's, absolutely.
You need to, I wouldn't say be on tenterhooks with certain countries, but there are places where it's like you need to sort of proceed with care and caution as to how you approach it, right?
So
it's
yeah.
You're not just dealing with a blanket group of people that are the same. I mean, how many countries? 180, 200, like it's different every time. And you know, that there was, who was on this morning? It was Dr. McTeer. She became famous in the SARS crisis and is all, you know, infectious disease specialist. And she was saying no one comes out of it, especially like organizations like the WHO or even your local health department, no one comes out of a pandemic looking particularly good.
Right.
Because it's not as if, you know, the results are never perfect, right?
We have a
body count here and people who are sick. You can't, the response is never going to be completely golden, right? There's elements of it that are going to be, we could have done this better, we could have done that better. And we learn from things like SARS and Ebola and Zika virus and whatever. But, you know, that's the thing. But for Trump to sort of put it all on the WHO.
Right.
And they paid a bit. I thought, what's it like? U.S. pays the most as usual, and then
one-fifth.
Bill Gates gives a ton of money to the. I had no idea.
Yeah,
that Bill Gates is one of the main funders, and of course, what's the American amount? It's something like $500 million, which is chump change to somebody like Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk. So they, if they really wanted to be the saints that they think they are, they could pick up that tab. But of course, there is a political aspect to that too, right?
Right.
To say Elon Musk overstepped, and other countries will pick it up. I mean, they just will, because they need that organization, right?
Well, it also,
they fix that organization. That's up to,
yeah,
you know, that's up to time and whatnot. But like I said, it's never ever going to be perfect, right?
Well, it might be one of these things where it's like the Trump thinking, I got to make big moves. I got to be, you know, immediate and responsive, and I got to just attack. And it could be that, and it could be like, we'll be here next week talking about how he reneged and decided to be magnanimous and made one of these pronouncements like, you know what, it's in our best interest to keep funding the WHO. I'm not happy about it, blah, 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 blah. We'll take a quick break, and we will get Loy Longfield queued up. You are listening to Open Sources Guelph. You're on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. I am now being joined by Loy Longfield, who is, of course, our Member of Parliament for Guelph here in the Royal City. Loy, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing well, Adam. It's unique times that we're living through.
Well, I try to start all these interviews by asking people how they're doing, just in a general sense. It's because these are strange times, as you said, and I know for politicians like yourself, for whom, you know, the public engagement part is kind of nonstop meetings, that, you know, kind of one-on-one interaction, that makes these times a bit more difficult for people in your position, right?
Yeah, there's a lot more people with a lot of very immediate concerns, and we're not talking too much about policy development, although there's still a little bit of that that goes on. But it's really how do we do our best to help people connect to the programs that are out there, as well as find out what programs aren't reaching them and what needs to be changed in order to get everybody looked after through the health and the financial crisis that we're going through.
That's a pretty good segue, because the first thing I was going to ask you about was the latest announcement from the Prime Minister, changes to the CERB, which is the Canadian Emergency Response Benefit, as you know. Can you talk a bit about the most recent changes and maybe how that came about?
You know, the change of recognizing some people are still making some income, and not enough to buy groceries or pay bills, but their hours are reduced. Maybe they have two or three part-time jobs and one job is still running, or maybe they're in essential services and their income has dropped down. And even though they still need to keep working because they're in an essential service, their income has been greatly reduced. So allowing for that, earning up to $1,000 a month, and still being able to qualify for CERB was something that I was very glad to see this morning. Of course, there's still more to come, and the Prime Minister indicated that, because we are also looking at individual contractors, sole proprietors. There's still a few people out there, several people out there that we've been working with to try and make sure they're covered in some way. Students, you know, big constituency of yours, heading into summer jobs, and what can be done there to support students. And so there's still work being done behind the scenes. And the way that work happens is we have a nightly conference call, 5:30 every night, 7 days a week. We took Easter Sunday off and Easter Monday off, which was nice, but right back at it again last night, to say, okay, this is what we're still hearing, what's the update? And the two big ones for us are still working on fine-tuning the CERB, and the second one is working on a rent relief for retailers or businesses that are in commercial properties. Mm. How can we get relief to the landlords of those properties and then flow that down somehow to the tenants, which normally falls into the province, but in our case, that's not happening in Ontario. So we're trying to find out what we can do federally to work on that. And again, the Prime Minister has made that comment in those last two statements that we know that's an issue. And something I was talking with finance last night about, and giving some good examples from Guelph and some contacts to some of the larger landlords in Guelph that have offered to give their input on what they think might work. So mm-hmm. We continue to work on that.
You kind of alluded to it, this being provincial jurisdiction, about the rent relief, because I know that Mike Schreiner's been pushing that pretty hard. And it makes me think about, too, sort of where the limits are in terms of what the federal government can do versus to what's provincial jurisdiction versus what is left for the city to do. Can you talk a little bit about how the government is maneuvering those sort of jurisdictional lines?
Well, sure. Well, I guess, first of all, Mike Schreiner and Cam Guthrie and I have regular calls, at least a few times a week, and then in between we're texting and calling each other on follow-up that we're working on together. Mike was in Queen's Park yesterday. They had a session on the floor there where he was advocating for rent relief, and as well as at least having no eviction for people that are, let's say, in a small business in downtown Guelph, in a heritage building, and no longer can generate income while we're going through this. So how do we get to those specific people? So Mike and Cam and I have talked about that. Cam has been talking about the property tax relief that is a city jurisdiction. And the federal jurisdiction is Canada Banking Act and working with the banks and mortgage holders. And, you know, there's the levers we can work on from the federal side have more to do with loans, with mortgages, with working with the banks to provide new products for them to help their clients with. And whether it's the interest-free loans that are going through the federal government, through the banks, to small businesses, or if it's lines of credit for the larger businesses up to $6.25 million worth of lines of credit through BDC and $6.25 million through EDC for the larger businesses that are working in trying to keep their doors open as well. So it's, the federal side is more the banking, and again, that's one of the issues we're still working on is on the up to $40,000 interest-free loan. You at the current state, you need a $50,000 minimum payroll, up to $1 million minimum payroll, and we're trying to relax that part, if not eliminate it, if possible. Mm-hmm. And so again, we're trying to get that accessible to more of the small businesses in Guelph that might not have a $50,000 payroll. And there's a larger firm in Guelph that has a more than $1 million payroll that would like to take part in that as well. And so you put out something quickly, hoping and that you're going to cover as much as you can, and you do cover a lot, and then you start finding out what didn't you cover, and now that's where the fine-tuning happens. Where usually these policies take months to develop and test and go to the market, we don't have months on these. We've got days and sometimes hours to put things through. May 1st rent check is going to be due, and May 1st isn't that far away. We've got a couple of weeks to figure out some of this stuff. So we are working 7 days a week on it. Public service is just amazing how responsive they are and how they're implementing at high speed and getting the CERB checks out as fast as they did, and millions of people getting benefit from that. It's just an incredible job by our civil service.
I mean, you're talking about the sort of the process of this, and I think that's helpful. I think from people from the outside looking in, though, they're seeing the government reaction through the CERB, and we're seeing as this goes along, whether it's the wage subsidy, whether it's the adding students or, you know, people who are still making some income to the CERB, the way the things have been tracking is that we're trying to cover everybody. And I guess in terms of the policy itself, and I know that some members of the opposition have been pushing for this, but why wasn't the immediate solution just to say, hey, everyone with, you know, let's say a social insurance number, we're going to give you $2,000 a month and just sort of like simplify it from there? Because that seems where we're going, right?
No, we still have a lot of people that are working.
Right.
And there's, you know, what we're doing is costing $70 billion, and if we were to cover the entire population of Canada and then try and get money back at the end of it, it's actually a more complicated process. Than getting the check out is a quick and easy thing you can do, but then doing the reconciling of that and you know, did you qualify for that check or not, and why not? It's actually better to spend the time up front to be more targeted, and there's less cleanup afterwards. Mm. And even as it was, we had some people that applied to EI and some that applied to CERB, and they got two checks. Some people applied to CERB twice, and they got two checks. So now we're going back to those people to say, well, hang on to that one check because you're not going to get one next period. And we're not going to ask for it back, but we're not going to be, at least at this stage, we're not asking for it back, but we're not going to be giving you a second $2,000 check in the next period. You've already got two checks. You can only get up to $8,000. And so if you've been double paid and you're going to be ending up going over $8,000, well, that's not going to happen either. So it's better to do the administration up front, and there's a lot less complicated cleanup on the backside of this. And on the backside of this, the economy is taking off again, and we want to make sure we're spending all of our time and effort on getting the economy up and running and not fixing something that could have been done by spending a little bit more time up front. It could have been done more efficiently.
Mm-hmm. Has there been that kind of discussion? I mean, obviously, people tune in to the press conferences at the White House every day, and they see the president there talking a lot about when the economy reopens. Has there been those kind of conversations in your nightly conference call, or is it like we're focused on the immediate term? And I mean, and also, how much of this too is truly in government control? Because the country's in lockdown. Yeah. There'd be no business anyway, even in the best of circumstances. So I guess I'm wondering, how deeply are you and the caucus looking at the future right now?
We do discuss the programs in particular that are going out to say, what's the lasting impact we can get from this program? So an example is we've increased the funding for homelessness in Guelph by about $720,000.
Mm-hmm.
And now working with the agencies working on the homelessness issues and people that are experiencing homelessness, we're saying, what could we do using that money that would have more lasting impact? So there's, you know, as we're putting money into solutions right now, we're looking at, can we get more of a long-term solution out of the money that we're spending today?
Right.
The conversations, I tend not to follow what's going on in the United States, because it's a totally different situation than what we have in Canada in more ways than one, especially from the administration. But also, one of the things I have seen from the States is the federal government getting confused on what's federal and what's state level.
Mm.
So the example here would be business, whether business is open or closed, or whether we reopen businesses is really a provincial issue. It's not a federal issue.
Right.
We work very closely with the provinces to know, you know, British Columbia and Alberta are recovering a little bit faster than the rest of the country. Maybe their reaction is going to be a little different on what businesses are opening and closing and when that might happen. We need to position ourselves for when that happens. But our nightly calls are really focused on how do we make sure that what we're putting out there is reaching everybody in our community. And so we have MPs from across the country talking about their communities. And last night's conference call, we were talking about fisheries and the seasonal workers in the fisheries. And then today's announcement was that people on seasonal work can still apply for CERB. Those announcements are coming directly from our conversations, which are really focused on the present. But having said that, this afternoon I've got a call talking about infrastructure investments in Guelph, and those will be post COVID-19. But they're just saying, what are the priorities in Guelph? We've got a very good one that's going to be announced as soon as we can that I spoke with the mayor about last night. The provinces have come to the table to match federal dollars on one of the projects that's going to be coming forward as soon as we can get construction happening again. So we are stacking up some of what we can start with as soon as it's safe to do so, but we're really following public health and we're following what we're hearing from the science testing and putting that all into the mix. The public health will give the advice to the provincial government. Public health nationally will be looking at the advice from the provinces. And we really follow their lead on when it's safe to start opening some of the doors again.
Mm. That infrastructure project you mentioned, does it by chance rhyme with Cryberry?
Oh, now you're getting creative. You're asking me to get into poetry. I don't know what I could say about that.
All right.
How's that for an evasion?
It was decent. I wanted to tap into your experience on the Ag Committee, because I've been noting some of the stories lately are about our food production processes, particularly in regards to the seasonal workers the migrant workers who come to Canada. What can you talk about maybe the response there and what some of the ongoing concerns are as we get into the planting season?
Yeah, well, one of the recent announcements, I think it was yesterday's announcement, was that people that are hiring temporary foreign workers will get $1,500 per worker to help with the self-isolation, because as they come to Canada, they have to be isolated for 14 days before they can start working. And what that means in real time for the farms that are hiring people from, let's say, Jamaica or other countries, is they need to have a trailer on site, because the bunkhouse, you can't isolate in a bunkhouse. So getting trailers put on site to help people isolate when they get here is one of the logistics issues that we're working with the farmers. But we're also working with farms.com, a local company that has developed a solution for the province, which is always cool when local companies are developing solutions for either the province or Canada. And they're connecting students to employment on the farm. So on the Ontario's website, there's a section, if you looked up agriculture jobs, they're trying to connect people that are maybe finishing up their programs now, they're in final exams. On the other side of that, maybe they might want to do some work on a farm locally. Well, that's available on Ontario's website. It's also on the Jobs Bank nationally, but the local solution from farms.com is to try and get some of our Canadian students working on helping with the planting season.
So it sounds like, I mean, it's not business as usual, but I know that farmers are worried about, you know, being able to start their work. I imagine a lot of those people who come here for the farming season are anxious to come and start making money. Shoppers are anxious, and of course we've just lived through the great, you know, shopping nightmare of all that. So it sounds like we are adjusting. It's just a matter of, I guess, talking about the future, changing how these things are done by, you know, how the workers are living and making sure that we can have those health concerns addressed so that they can start work proper.
Yeah, we are adjusting, but the retailers, the grocery stores are really struggling with buying patterns they've never seen before. You know, we started with toilet paper. I was talking to one of my daughters works in a store and that has nail polish remover. There's a big run on nail polish remover. Well, how do you restock the shelves when your systems they're set up for how many units have you bought over this period of time?
Right.
And then they forecast to an annual amount. Well, none of that's working right now. So the people that are trying to keep shelves stocked are having trouble with their forecasting. The truck drivers driving and delivering, the people stocking the shelves, because the sporadic buying patterns that people are buying more than they usually buy of different items, it's really played havoc in that market. I've been pulled onto the industry committee. Last term, I sat on the industry committee for the entire session, and we're starting our virtual meetings next week. That we'll be looking at different impacts on Canadian business. And we're also looking at the future of Canadian businesses. A lot of businesses are going to be changing how they work at the end of this. There's a lot more people using remote, you know, work out of home. There's people that are using delivery services more. So the shopping experience is different now. The huge market that we have around building testing equipment, building ventilators, building protective equipment in Canada, big market for that now. Canada is going to be making more than we need. So I'll be sitting on the industry committee through the rest of this emergency to bring some of our local experience to that table. Innovation Guelph has some clients that are developing testing equipment, and another one that's doing some analysis, DNA analysis equipment. We've got some manufacturers locally that are pivoting to making parts for ventilators. So all of that's going to really impact on the longer term different types of business activities going on.
Right. I like to ask this question. I'll ask this variation. It's a question I usually ask in these interviews. But in terms of things you are hearing about, things that you're trying to deal with that maybe aren't getting talked about in the news or in the community or online on social media or whatever, what's kind of like something that's going under the radar right now that you're working on or that has you worried?
People aren't showing up to work because they're not feeling safe.
Mm.
And so the companies that are trying to still operate are having trouble hiring people, and they're having trouble retaining people. And the result is the people that are working longer hours. And that's going to have an impact. I mean, people are going to burn out. I think how we handle our labor force in terms of fair pay for everybody, how we identify needs in the labor force and line those up with people that are still looking for work. It's been something I've worked on for many years now, is how do we match skills? I think we need to really start bringing that forward because, as I said, we've got, let's say, older people in the workforce that don't feel comfortable leaving the house because they're at higher risk, because maybe they have some other medical issues. How do we get those positions filled temporarily? And then how do we look at an ongoing filling of some positions that are just going to be very difficult for us to fill in the future?
Mm-hmm.
So that's happening under the radar. I've talked to some of the service agencies in downtown Guelph that are saying, you know, we had all these people that were helping out with meals, and now we're down to 3 people, and we used to have a dozen people.
Right.
And we had people delivering meals to doors, and now we don't. So we have some current needs to fill on our workplace, and that's what I'm working on this afternoon is our Canada Summer Jobs, and I've got a listing of about 600 jobs that we're going to be funding through the employers. They'll get 100% subsidy for hiring people. And I'm hoping that's going to help fill some of our needs in Guelph, but 600 jobs is really just a starting point. There are other jobs out there that aren't on my list that we have to try and find and help with matching.
Mm-hmm. I asked Mike this last week because I know that a lot of people are looking for direction. They may have issues, they may have concerns, and they're trying to find out like where to direct them, if it's a municipal issue, provincial or federal. So just, you know, for anyone who's listening, what kind of problems is your office dealing with? Like, what's in your jurisdiction as the MPP, or as the Member of Parliament?
We deal a lot with employment insurance related issues, Canada Pension Plan, federal payment issues, and things that go through the CRA. And that's why we're so involved with these new programs, the CERB and the wage subsidy programs, because those flow through the CRA. So things that have to do with your tax filing, your income tax, those are generally going to be federal issues. There's some provincial income tax as well, but generally they're going to be federal issues. The bringing people back to Canada was a massive job we had in the first 2 weeks. We had people stranded in about 16, I think, different countries that my staff was working on with Global Affairs to bring them home. So things to do with passports, immigration, temporary foreign workers, all of anything dealing with other countries generally would fall under federal jurisdiction. And then some of the programs, any of the programs I said earlier about banking, anything to do with a bank or a credit union is going to fall under federal jurisdiction. We're also working on food inspection. So $20 million going into CFIA to try and keep our meat processing lines open. Right now we're having trouble with our meat processing lines across Canada. So Health Canada, CFIA, Canadian Food Inspection Agency, falls under Health Canada. anything to do with the global health issues would fall under federal jurisdiction as well. Delivery of health is provincial, and working with the hospital is provincial, working with the delivery of services in the downtown for the social services, those are provincial issues. A lot of federal government, but then the delivery of services is provincial.
So Lloyd Longfield, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for the insights, and hopefully we'll get to have you back in the studio in person sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I always like visiting you and Scotty. I look forward to getting up onto the 1.5 floor, maybe it's the second floor at University Center. So thank you for covering the story and all the different angles you're working on to try and get all the information out for the public. So I appreciate it, Adam.
And that was, once again, Lloyd Longfield, our Member of Parliament. It was nice to hear from Lloyd. It's nice to catch up with all our open sources friends in these difficult times.
Absolutely. It's an open invite these days, really, right? So.
Oh, absolutely. And we're going to try and get some more people on as we go along. And
we're still trying to get Justin working on it.
He's going back into his cottage right now. Maybe he's going to get on the phone.
Is he really?
Yeah.
Cross the border and not harassed by the police on the bridge. Probably not, eh?
All right, let's...
Topic for another day, yeah.
Let's finish the show. If you liked our show, you can, of course, stay connected to us at our website, opensourcesguelph.com. Find us on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire and on Twitter at @OS_Guelph. If you'd like to listen to the show again, you can download it from our website every Monday or at the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or on your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, and you can check out my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and the odds of something being at spannerbook.wordpress.com this week are really, really good. Excellent odds, greatest odds, best odds. So.
That sounds great.
Everything's great. Perfect.
Perfect
block.
You can stay tuned for more programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back next Thursday at 5 p.m. for another remote episode of Open Sources, and we will see you then.